Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
This week's episode of the Bass Guitar Nerds podcast is sponsored by Ashdown Engineering, a British bass amplification powerhouse whose gear is seen on the biggest stages in the world, backing up the biggest bands in the world. Ashdown are famous for their big rock and roll amplifiers, but they also do a fantastic and broad range of super lightweight and versatile combo amps in their studio series. Simple, classic design, these silver-faced top-mounted controlled amps come in a range of sizes for everything from your first practice amp to a full 115-300-watt combination amplifier that's just as suitable at home as on a stage. With foot-switchable valve-emulated drive and a neodymium speaker, this is a perfect solution for players looking for portability whilst retaining that classic bass tonality. Check them out at ashdownmusic.com or follow links in the description of this podcast. And welcome to the Bass Guitar Nerds podcast by Guitar Nerds. This is the third episode of the Bass Guitar Nerds podcast. Thank you very much, listener, for tuning in, and welcome to the first ever bass exclusive content that Guitar Nerds has created. I am your host, Joe Branton, joined this week by Naomi McLeod.
Hello.
And JD Short.
Hello.
There we go. Yes, absolutely. And It's hotter than Mars at the moment in the UK when we're recording this, dear listener. You know, I know, like, just under half of you are in the UK, so you're experiencing this heat as well. Elsewhere in the world, I imagine the temperature is normal for you, but this is not something that certainly I am used to. So we're struggling somewhat, but I think we can get through it.
I'm pretty sure I've reduced to a small cloud of mist right now.
Yes, I'm sure that my clothes are more sweat than clothing at the moment. Mm-hmm. But, you know, it's going to be fine. We're going to get through this. Because, yes, there's actually a load of exciting bass stuff to talk about. For the first time this week, the last 2 weeks, we've spoken about Naomi and JD's bass collection, amplifier choice, and pedal boards. And we really had to try and squeeze in the pedal boards in last week's episode because everyone had such kind of substantial
boards.
We
use a lot of pedals. Yeah.
But we did make it through. So now, hopefully, listener, if you're tuning in for the third episode, then you have a good idea of what each host's preferences are. So this week, we can talk a little bit more about questions that we're taking from the Guitar Nerds Facebook group, facebook.com/groups/Guitar Nerds Forum. And we're also going to be talking about some news in the world of bass guitars. Now, I guess I must apologize because I realized when I was writing this up that, you know, I know that the bass guitar world is absolutely riddled with awesome, modern, extended range, spalty things. And I know that that's the area that Guitar Nerds ignores because we just like tellies and vintage amps. And I realized writing up this week's episode that every news item and thing that we're planning to talk about tends to be retro reissues and classically styled stuff. So we will try and branch out into some of the weirder areas of the bass guitar world, because I think the bass guitar world has so many weird areas. But for now, we're just going to talk about some incredibly cool stuff. And I guess I want to talk about the new Ceric bass that got announced this week, just after we talked about them on the first episode.
Indeed. So it was August 1st, I think, was the release date for the Sarek Grand. Also, interestingly, the first batch-made Sarek model. So I think everything up till now had been one-off custom builds.
Right.
Which obviously had been sent to stores and open to customers to buy individually. But I spoke briefly to Jake Sarek recently, and he was super excited about getting this first batch model out. So it's totally new body shape for Sarek. It's got that unusual matching offset pick guard.
It's kind of the body shape on the lower half reminds me of the 12 string Fender. I can't remember the model name. Anyone?
No.
Yeah. It recently got reissued as we don't have to know about guitars on this podcast. Yeah. It's fine.
No, well, that's going to kill me now until I find it.
Especially guitars with even higher strings.
Yeah, I mean, you are blowing our 4 and 5 and 6 stringed minds here.
Yeah. It was called the Maverick. That's what it was released as, a 6-string in the Parallel Universe series. Yes.
Indeed. The Electric 12 was the one I was thinking of.
Yes, that would have made more sense for me to be talking about. I specifically meant the Parallel Universe series.
Yes,
of course. But yes, it has that similar sort of offset underside to that. But it is a very unique shape for Sarek.
Yeah, for sure. I'm into the asymmetry of it. Especially because, in contrast, the Midwestern has a very symmetrical body, has kind of equal size horns.
Yeah.
It's got that kind of Italia airline style styling on the pickguard, which I'm super into. It's got an offset pickup, which is, yeah, it's the TV Jones Thunderblade.
Which is great. I have a couple of those.
Oh, really? What sort of thing are they?
They're just like, for me, like pretty beefy sort of humbuckers, like very vintage style. So I had one of the 1968 custom with a K basses that they made for a couple years. It was a short scale that was one that I had done a lot of Frankensteining to, in that I tried to make it half Rickenbacker, half Alembic, half everything else, and it was totally great. But yeah, like the TV Jones were the pickups I bought to replace a lot of the old like the original pickups for it. So those TV Jones, right. Yeah, the Thunderblades are just big beefy pickups, like, and they look rad. So
yeah, they look super cool. I think there's quite a few Rickenbacker nods in Sarek styling generally.
I guess there is. The headstock certainly. Yeah.
Just enough to not be a lawsuit, probably.
yeah, for sure. And cool enough that it absolutely looks like he's put his own mark on them. So I really, really like that. I was almost speechless when I read this. Such was my excitement. You might know what I'm about to say. Yeah. But it's got a frickin' onboard passive fuzz circuit.
Yeah.
I mean...
Yeah. And it's circuit with an SE.
Yeah.
And an RKIT, the SCUS circuit.
Oh, yeah, of course.
In my handy Irish accent for my overpronounced or. that's freaking cool. I really, really want to... I mean, I wanted to try it already, but this makes me want to try it about 10 times more.
And I think the SE, like, circuit is also a nod that the fuzz sounds like Andy Serkis doing, like, an impression or one of his... voiceovers that he does for so many sci-fi movies.
I see, right.
I think that's what it is.
Yeah, a nice touch.
Very cool.
Indeed.
Do you know if it only comes in the one finish?
I believe it's only the one finish.
So it's like a graffiti yellow with an orange sort of Fender-style speed stripe running across the bass at, really annoyingly for my OCD, a slightly different angle from the pickup.
It's giving me DHL vibes.
Yeah.
In a bad way, just like packaging. I saw that, now it's hard. It was the Italia Airlines like scratch plate, and then I was like, yeah, that's another airplane you may see on a runway.
You may have exposed Sarek's favorite courier, his preferred service, his subconscious color taste. I think it's awesome looking as a finish. I wouldn't normally... I wouldn't normally lean towards a yellow finish, but it's banging looking overall. I think like what I like about it is just the combination of entirely kind of interesting design decisions that he's taken, from the pick guard to the fuzz circuit to the pickup choice to the racing stripe to the body shape.
He definitely hasn't played it safe on his first ever like batch built guitar.
No, but I really like that about it.
Yeah.
I think if you're going to go for it, go big or go home.
Yeah. And they've said these batches are going to be built semi-annually as well and sold as first come, first served. And you can't customize or pre-order.
That tells me it probably is the one finish.
Yeah,
then.
It must be the one finish. But I think a fantastic idea. A great price that he seems to have set these at. $1,850 US.
Which is,
you know, when you think that this is still, I know they're batch built, but it is still, Cerec is still a custom shop. And look at the features you're getting on this. The unique finish, the speed stripe, the incredible scratch plate, the TV Jones Thunderblade, the passive fuzz circuit. Kind of everything about this is screams premium, and yet you're paying less money than you would for a US made P bass.
I mean the nitro finish too, and like the hip shot hardware is just such a nice, like, it's basically everything you would if you got a bass like this and then made a bunch of adjustments to it. They're all the adjustments that I would make.
Yeah,
I think, you know, like, it's all like, oh, well, it's already there. Great.
It does feel like that a bit, doesn't it? It kind of looks and feels a bit like a sort of chop shop a bass, but, you know, something that you can buy for a very reasonable price. I don't know what Chechen is as a fingerboard material. Is that how you say it?
I'm not sure either. It's what it looks like. It's, you know, I think, I mean, we know this a lot of just, there's so many new woods coming into the market, you know, that it's not the same that you, certainly in the bass world, it's not the same that you've seen 10, 15 years ago, even outside of restrictions around ebony and rosewood, you know, so.
I'm not sure. Sounds cool. Poplar body, you know, it's like these are, the, you know, obviously poplar something you see more on budget instruments, but nothing that's going to nothing that's going to tonally take away from how good the instrument is. And certainly poplar is something that we're seeing used more and more. I mean, as you know, I don't know what Chechen is, but like Indian laurel is the sort of rosewood replacement that Squire and now Fender have kind of really started getting on board with. Mm-hmm. It's starting to appear more and more, and I think that's kind of what it takes. People just need to acclimatize themselves with the new woods to kind of be okay with using them. And although I don't know if that's the same with bass players, I think we're much more willing to go for sort of odd woods.
Yeah, I mean, I think we've just been more exploratory broadly with wood choices. And one, you need different characteristics to be able to sustain a longer scale length, to be able to sustain the, you know, more energy in the string itself. Like, they respond differently. It's like how you end up with Bubenga, like, before you saw Bubenga guitars. Turns out Chechen is what it's called. It's basically a Caribbean rosewood, so Dominican Republic, Cuba, Jamaica, and like southeastern Mexico is mostly where it's from. So, same sort of vibes.
Oh, sweet. Oh, well, I will be very excited to see how this one does. I don't know what quantities it's being built in, but I'm, you know, really excited. I hope they do more batch builds. I actually really like the idea of batch building as a general idea. I think it's a great way to for smaller companies to introduce affordable models. You know, and not solely rely on the people that have sort of $4,000 plus to throw at custom shop versions of their guitars.
That's very true. I think as well, I wonder, from a business point of view, is it a better way potentially to get the instruments into stores and to get the word out and to get to more players, you know, those who maybe aren't following
Yeah.
All of their favorite bassists will be shouting about their new custom models on Instagram and stuff like that. Yeah. So it's definitely the good word of Sarek. I hope it continues to spread because having tried a few of the models, I've just been blown away by each. And I hope I get my hands on a grand potentially at some stage. It does say the first batch is sold out, so obviously not a first batch one, but he's saying next batch in winter, so this is that's pretty soon. That's pretty cool.
There you go. Well, at the other end of the price range and also in Chicago, and this time unfortunately exclusive to Chicago, Chicago Music Exchange have teamed up with Squire, as they want to do from time to time, and released Chicago Music Exchange. Definitely have developed an obsession with Shell Pink, which I do feel is really kind of stealing, you know, guitar nerds' thunder here. We've been Pink guitar nerds enthusiasts for 6 years, and all of a sudden, Chicago Music Exchange limited edition. Everything they're doing limited edition seems to be Pink. They have a Shell Pink Gibson SG coming out later this year as an exclusive as well. It seems to, you know, someone there listens to us. Anyway, but they have released a Squire Affinity Bronco bass in Shell Pink, which is very exciting.
Where do I pay?
Yeah, yeah. I know, exactly. Well, it's, and this is the thing, you can pay $33 a month for 6 months for this.
I'm seeing this. This is awesome. This is going proper high street now, right?
Finance
just seems easier than ever. And then when you throw an affordable instrument into the mix, it's just like,
this is very cool. And I know we talked about, we talked about, Naomi, your Bronco mod. And the Bronco is such a fantastic instrument to mod because essentially its basics are very good. You know, the neck profile, the body are all fine. It's just, you know, hardware pickup upgrades.
Yeah, for sure. And your tone controls are super simple. It works excellently as a blank canvas, essentially, doesn't it?
Exactly, which is why. And I might have mentioned this when we talked about your Bronco, I can't remember, but it's exactly why James's Home of Tone, which is my favourite UK sort of small guitar shop, actually offer a complete Bronco upgrade kit, which includes, so it comes with like a McNelly pickup replacement, and then I think new I've got to find it to be able to actually talk about it, I guess, but and then it comes with all new wiring for it, new like lovely looking white knobs that match the plate. And it's just a fantastic way of actually making that into a premium instrument, which of course you can do much as Naomi did, but this is a great way of doing it without having to think about anything, or source parts separately.
Or cry into a chisel over your Bronco for a week.
Yes, here we... Exactly, exactly.
Yeah. Let's just say I wish I had heard of James at Home of Tone earlier. But look,
yes, they are very good. Yeah, so
yeah,
you can
awesome.
You can purchase a pre-wired bass guitar wiring harness for $39.99, and you can include a McNelly sort of tiny little humbucker with it as well, that comes with a lovely white cover, so it will still kind of match everything else, for £159 for the harness and the pickup, which is a very reasonable price to pay for kind of a real complete upgrade. I mean, maybe you want to change the tuners on there as well as a separate, but I do think as far as tone is concerned, that pre-wired bass guitar wiring harness is all you need. And that coupled with a Shell Pink Bronco removes the fact that you might want to refinish that Bronco. So all of a sudden you've got like a really kind of all singing, all dancing guitar for, you know, and unique guitar for less than £360.
Awesome.
Oh no, I guess it's in dollars, isn't it? The Bronco.
$199. Even so, I mean, that's still a super affordable finished mod, if you like, with the ease of installation that James Home of Tone has included in his pack.
Yeah, absolutely. Right. Now, I need everyone's help on something moving forward. But actually, before I do that, JD, all your pedals have turned up.
They have, yes.
And actually, Naomi, you've been and picked up all of your gear as well. So you both have everything here now, right?
And this wasn't planned between myself and JD, just to clarify. This wasn't to be sprung on you all at once, Joe, that we would both shout about all our gear. But yeah, JD, yours arrived from the States, and simultaneously I managed to fetch mine from Ireland as well.
You had some fantastic pedals turn up, JD, along with kind of everything else, including the old Boss high pass flanger.
Yeah, so it's I really like that flanger, and then it's basically just a, you can have it just affect really the upper signal of, and it, you know, ideally it was originally designed, I think, for like guitar and keys. It's kind of how I think about it, but it, like on bass, I think it's just really great, because I'm sometimes not a huge fan of filter effects going really low into my frequency. So I often run, you know, varying stages of crossover, kind of depending on what I'm doing, like my Limbic preamp, which is here again, touching it now, is like, has a built-in crossover. So I'll run, like, recording wise, like different effects and stuff through there. I have a couple of different boards though with crossovers built in, and I'll, or bi-amping or anything like that, because why not, right? But it's just like, the pedal itself is just really nice, just to have the, just sort of the upper level flange happening works exceptionally well with drive and distortions, just so you get all the, like, the odd harmonics coming out that you can really just put a flange on top of without, like, getting that old, like, sort of Roland jet phase sort of sound, you know, with it, which I know are separate effects, but still, you know, like that, where you just have a big fuzz that the whole thing is moving. It's just really nice to have, like, additional movement, sort of up top only. It's great. Plus, it's a banging color too. It's like the light purple, which is probably going to be what the bass guitar nerds should shift into instead of a shell pink. We'll figure out some sort of like electric mauve or something. Yeah. We'll start seeing who falls for it next.
Yeah, but Guy Pratt's Burgundy Mist is where I want to go with this. That's the ultimate color. Naomi, what about you? What basses did you? Have all your basses come over now?
Just about all of my basses have. I've left one. I mean, I really don't know why at this stage. I left my kind of old reliable, I suppose, which is simply a 2004 Mexican Jazz. Left that in Dublin, I think subconsciously thinking, you know, if I have gigs that it'll be handy there. But I mean, who knows about that? Still. Everything else has come over with me, though. Yes, so the Bronco has joined me. We had a tough separation there for a little while, so I'm delighted to have it back. Have my Reverend Mercalli 5. I always get the order of words mixed up, but I also have it's either 2011 or 2012 FSR Deluxe Active P-Bass in metallic seafoam.
I remember when this came out. Yeah, the metallic seafoam, and it's PJ purloid plate, right?
It is, yes, an active.
Purloid
PJ, and has a jazz neck.
That's right, and it's maple with black blocks, isn't it?
Yes, that's exactly it. Yeah,
this was definitely. I remember when this bass came out, and I was working at GAC at the time, and this bass really felt to me like a. At first, I very much liked it, but then I was like, does this not just have everything on it? You know, it's not one thing that they change. It was like, we're changing a jazz neck. We're also going to make it maple with black block inlays. We're also going to make it PJ. It's also going to be active. We're going to put a priority plate. It's kind of, you know, it was sort of everything all at once.
Yeah, I believe the cool kids call it extra.
Right,
extra bass.
I see. How did you find it? Because I've always been on the fence about when Fender try to do active things.
Sure. Well, it's I had to double check. Yes, it is still my only active bass. So I had kind of shied away from active personally for a long time, and just stuck with passive. I mean, even the, you know, a lot of people ask me, is my Reverend Mercalli 5 active? I think a lot of people assume that a lot of Reverends are active, but they're not. And in the case of the PJ, a little bit like yourself, I actually was working in a store in Dublin at the time, and it kind of turned into the bass that got away. I remember really regretting not buying it because it just felt so cool. And just the idea of, you know, the solidity of the P tone, but matched with a jazz neck. I've always kind of lent more towards the jazz neck. And then finally, I mean, really, by the time I tracked one down, which was only last year, I think it was July 2019, I finally bought one when it came up for sale here in the UK. I mean, by then I'd kind of played and borrowed enough active basses that it kind of had stopped being anything that I sort of mind. So it's fine, really. Nice loud output.
Does it have an active passive switch, or does it have to be active?
It has to be active.
Right. So the same as is that old Mexican deluxe series that Fender did, where it had to be active. Because of course, on all the American deluxes, they always had an active passive.
Yes, they did. Yeah. Yeah, this is a Mexican build, actually. So
yeah. Oh yeah, of course it is.
Yeah. So I think in that sense the specs are sort of in line with the Mexican deluxes.
Yeah, I see. JD, do you remember that you used to always play like a quite similar spec to this jazz bass, right? Was that active as well?
Yeah, it was active passive, so it was an American deluxe. Which again was sort of that same idea that it was like, if it's a jazz bass with all the mods that I would do to it, except for the mods I did additionally, what would I get? And it was just, you know, like it was the 70s style with the big, maple body, alder body maple board, with the big block inlays and like the black binding and everything, so like that vibe, and then the black scratch plate and active passive and sort of all that. And then I swapped it out for, as I do with most things that aren't my Stonefield, like Nordstrom pickups. And then I did have Aguilar pickups in it for a while, which I really liked. Their noiseless ones were really really great, but that was sort of my fly bass that I would go with for a long time. I took on planes and stuff,
right? See, yeah, they were really cool, really underrated instruments, I thought. Because you had that active passive switch, they made me far more kind of interested in them, just because I had the option of that sort of more traditional jazz bass tone. But yeah, I really love that 70s jazz bass style. It's something that Fender have really done a good job of cottoning onto the fact that bass players like that look, because it's one of the few things they've made available at every tier. You know, you think from a Squire, it was like the only good Squire Vint mod years ago. It was like £300, and it weighed a ton because I think it was an ash body and a maple board, and the five string especially I remember being utterly backbreaking. But then they did it the whole way up. They offered it as a Mexican deluxe, as an American deluxe. It was something you could buy kind of in every area. And I guess kind of coming back to Naomi's bass, how do you both feel about PJ as a pickup configuration?
It's more contentious than I thought. I just fundamentally really like it. I really like having the option there. Like, I mean, I love a P pickup on its own. I love a P positioning on its own. And I suppose just having the option to add the, or rather to blend, kind of the more gnarly, bridge position just works for me.
Would you consider yourself more precision than jazz?
I'm not just saying this because of the previous question. I would consider myself in the middle. Right. Yeah. It's me. I am PJ. I am a big fan of both. I wouldn't. I know quite a lot of people lean quite heavily towards either P or J, but I think when I first discovered PJ as a configuration, it really stuck with me.
Right. I see.
Yeah. I would agree with that. Like I really like PJ, certainly, like, because I quite like, I think tonally, well, it's tough because I think I'm also in the middle. Like, I really like the sound of a P bass. And if I'm playing a jazz bass, like with, or two jazz pickup spacing, like I almost always leave them on both full. Sometimes a little more neck, but I rarely go for like the, you know, bridge sound of a J.
Right.
But all that being said, like there's something amazing about PJs that just for some reason scream 80s to me, and I'm not quite sure why, but it always just seems like
it's Yamaha like the BBs.
Yeah, something. Mm-hmm. It's something, or it's like all the like the Aria Pros, or like you start seeing other things that have those, and you know, it's certainly when like DiMarzio was doing like the Cream, you know, like where everyone had like the Cream plastic covers for everything, and you're like, this doesn't really work with anything, but it's so amazing now.
There's a wonderfully large amount of 70s precision basses where people have butchered jazz bass pickups into them, and now they're, you know, only worth a grand instead of, you know, three.
Yeah, great.
Yeah. Fine with me.
But yeah,
good,
but,
says us.
Yeah, also with that, like I started thinking about like PJs, and I think about like some of the great like Spectres and stuff that are out there, and like a lot of those have like PJ configurations, and like they're sort of my secret kind of, I have a secret the affinity Spectre. For those, where it's just like there's like the EMGs, and then like the super crisp sound, and just like it, they're just being so active.
Brass saddles. Let's talk about Spectre. What a fantastic brand. The Czech built stuff was always really good, and now most of it comes with Aguila pickups now, because I think, well, because Barnes and Mullins in the UK distribute Spectre and also Aguila, and seem to have quite a lot, seem to be quite involved in both companies, really. You're starting to see more and more Spectres turn up with Aguila rather than... Oh, wait, what did we agree the pronunciation was?
It's either.
Aguila.
It's
okay. I did it wrong again, didn't
it's I? Tomato, tomato. Oh,
fine.
Tomato, fine. Tomato. Not saying it's definitely Aguilar, but...
Aguilar. I need to... I'll try and get that. Well, it doesn't even matter. When you guys say it immediately before me, I then immediately go, Aguila. No, okay, Aguila. Okay, fine.
I mean, to be fair, Alex could correct us all.
Yeah,
it's true. It's true, and we'd listen.
Yeah,
yeah,
so. Sure,
yeah,
great,
exactly.
But yeah, yes. I mean, Spectre. Mostly, just I was thinking about this when you were speaking before about how everything we talk about is like, well, you know, we're passive. We want all this, you know, like retro vibey sort of stuff, and then it's like, but also Spectres are banging, and also like, to be fair, have also been around for 40 years or more, you know, and so it's like, also, if you think about it, a Spectre, like Spectre bodies are vintagey, you know, like
it's
rough to think about now, but it's like,
they are. It's such a wonderful, weird thing. They're like, they're so modern looking. If you think about that weird, like, I love the tummy contour. I love that they're designed around my beer belly. That's fantastic for me. It's on the Euro 4s and 5s. I just think, you know, I know that that shape obviously was sold to Warwick, and Warwick then ran with it.
It's the first and only Warwick I had.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
What was the Warwick shape called?
Oh, it was like it wasn't the Masterman.
Streamer.
No.
Was it? No?
They had like it was a very specific version of it where they had like it was like the Spectre body, a Music Man pickup, and then all the like traditional like Warwick like accoutrement, you know, where it was like the like Bubenga and Wingay, and then it was like they had like the countersunk strap locks like built in, so they didn't like stick out from the body, and there's just like such a nice touch for stuff like that, and it was I played that bass. It was my first real proper, like, had to source this bass from some store like hundreds of miles away from where I lived kind of place, you know, like one of those spaces. But
brass nut as well.
And the adjuster nut, like the one where you could like individually, you could, was just little screws for the saddles, yeah, like in the nut, so you can like raise and lower them.
Yeah, I remember that. That was ridiculous. Yeah, it was a fixed brass nut, I think, on the Spectres.
Yeah.
But yeah, they're just so cool. I was very lucky. I got to interview Doug Windisch, who, you know, essentially responsible for making basses into almost soundscape instruments. Like he makes it sound. He doesn't use it as a bass or a guitar. He can do anything with it. He just has this weird like ability to address the instrument for the sound it produces rather than any sort of playing with any sort of style.
He's just 100% why I've purchased and sold a whammy pedal,
right?
like probably 3 or 4 times over now, just because I love Doug Windisch so much.
He's so cool. When I interviewed him, he turned up with his Spectre Doug Windisch. And when I say he turned up with his Spectre Doug Windisch, I mean the one.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
And he was telling me about it. It was like, no, this is just the one. This is the one that they made him when they started doing it. And I was like,
wow.
You've been playing one of these for my whole life. Like, yeah. For at least the last 20 years since I became aware of you, you've been playing this. And it's like the same one. It's so battered and beat up. And it's kind of like, you know, I interviewed him in Brighton. It was like, you flew this over here. get them to just supply you with one here, you know. Don't bring this is a piece of history. But
well, it's like when Bobby Vega always travels with his bass, and you're just like, this thing should, you know, like, is destined for some museum of greatness. And like, it's just like yeah, it's just my bass, you know. Like, it's just,
you know, coming back round to that sort of precision versus jazz, I actually think he's responsible for getting me into realizing that I prefer jazz basses to precision basses. Was when I saw how ridiculously relict his was, and how incredibly cool it still looked. One of the most unique playing styles as well, that man.
For sure.
Plectrum, it's...
So, upside down plectrum, yeah.
Also, just want to do a fun little callback trivia for everyone, that the NS1s, those Spectre NS1s, the NS is Ned Steinberger. So those are Ned Steinberger design Spectres.
Oh, I didn't know.
Yeah. Yep.
Oh, why don't I own a Spectre?
I've come so close so many times, but it's like there's... It's just one of those things, like, I would have one to have one, and I feel like I would play it a lot, but I would never use it, probably. Yeah.
I think that's what makes me back out of basses like this all the time, is that, and I imagine a lot of bass players have this. A lot of bass players, Naomi, you seem to have quite a lot of taste in the instruments that you choose. But for a lot of...
But by contrast.
That's what I was kind of. But like every now and again, I just want to buy something ridiculous. I want a Spectre Euro 4 LX in spalted poplar, but I just know that there's no way my band will let me walk onto a stage with that. You know, there's no way I could possibly play in like a rock band with this bass that's louder than everything else on the stage.
Yeah, I get what you mean. And in fact, I've heard a lot of people say that, you know, oh, I love this, or it sounds amazing, but like I couldn't be seen dead on stage with it. And I don't know. I don't know. Am I taking a bit of a hard angle with it? But it makes me a bit sad. I think like if you find something that sounds absolutely incredible, why do yourself the disservice? Or equally, if you find something that just looks so far out there that you want to take a wild plunge. I mean, I think the last one of those for me that I nearly bought but didn't, and I'm beginning to regret now, was a PV Foundation bass.
Oh, they were so good, yeah, but they were so spalty.
It was like a little, what was that super famous but affordable Mazda sports car that like changed the affordable sports car world? Was it like the MR5?
MX5?
We're clearly out of our depth here.
There was
quickly and instantly out of our depth.
There was a cheap car.
Models of basses from 20 years before we were born, but like give us a car like that. Taurus? Do you think they named it after Billy Sheehan's band?
Yeah, right. But the one that I had my eye on, it was sort of this equivalent. I mean, it was this beautiful kind of I don't know, slightly cola red, gold hardware, that super pointy headstock, maple body. It weighed a ton, but it sounded
It sounded so
unbelievable.
Good.
Yeah. And again, like, you know, I hasten to add, I do love expensive instruments. I feel like I've come on this podcast and pretty much exclusively talked about things under the kind of $300 range. But I mean, this was super cheap only because it's an older secondhand instrument that's just not quite as sought after as some of the more star players. But an unbelievable sounding bass that, again, I did potentially hear a few people sort of snicker at it and think, God, it's so naff looking or whatever. And I thought, you know what? It sounds awesome. And hence you are wrong.
They were absolutely fantastic. I completely loved them. I did the videos for GAC of them when they came in. And it was at a time when I was like, I only play Gibson basses. I don't touch anything else. I was going through this real sort of like, no, if Jack Bruce didn't play it, it doesn't matter. Yeah. But then I played one of these and I remember being like, oh, it's so good. And it was so not my style that I didn't buy it, but I really regret it. I can't, like those big soap bar pickups were just so, they were fantastic. They were so expressive and so wonderful. It was like a supercharged jazz bass, but in only a good way.
It's just a different take completely, and it's good to have that, you know. I mean, it's really nice to have a bunch of trusty, very classic basses, but I think, you know, I think you should have some different strings to your bow for whatever gig or band may call for it.
I'm thinking about this now, like now I'm thinking about like some sort of like electric candy red bass with like gold hardware and like all the stuff that's like so tacky and audacious that it just becomes amazing in its own way. Like one of the things, so like this is probably says way too much about me, but I still have the first issue of Bass Player that I ever purchased, which was the buyer's guide. And so it was just gear reviews, which is probably what set me out of my course. So, you know, like I remember it was the first magazine. I was on like a family holiday.
Was it a smaller size?
I mean, it was no. It was just normal, like magazine size. But it was just like it was. Yeah, it wasn't like a pocket buyer's guide or anything. It was just the magazine that was just issue, and it was just reviews after reviews, and then like half of it was just manufacturer addresses and everything. You know, like it was basically like an industry mag, and I didn't know any, but that was like the thing I poured over, and I was just like reading all these things, and I was like, oh, these are all the bases I want in it, and. And I still have it, and it's one of the things that came over with all my stuff. So I should, like, I'll take some photos and just show some of it. Because it's like some of the reviews, like, you're naming when you were talking, it was reminding me of there's like this like bonkers Epiphone model of something that was still like, it was like old and new. And it was sort of like 90s. So it was like when everyone was just trying stuff. You know, like musically and instrument wise, and it was all just trying to figure out. And I think one of the early issues I had also had like the PV MIDI bass, like on like the back cover or something. It was like the first real go of like, this bass is just a MIDI controller, you know, kind of thing. And I was like, oh, I wanted a bass that could sound like a flute, you know, like so badly.
And a banjo all at once. With only 4 seconds of latency. I mean, this is the future.
Yeah. I remember going into I can't remember what it was. I wish I could remember what the guitar shop was so that I could name and shame them for the salesman being so clearly orientated towards making margin on the instrument he was saying. Because I remember being very young, going in to buy my first... like Fender bass, you know, that sort of thing. Like I was in punk band, so you had to play a precision bass at that time. And he handed me, he was like, well, you should definitely try this out. And it was the Line 6 Variax bass.
No.
The one with no pickups.
Yeah.
And I remember that at that particular point, and of course, as Naomi, you're exactly right. Oh no, they were terrible. But at that point in time, before you know anything, when you're like 16 years old, that was like, this bass has no visible pickups and it can sound like any bass or a flute, you know. It's just that was cool at the time, and I remember playing that and being like, wow, I wish I could afford this, but no, I will just buy the P bass. But
some say you would end up, or some would say you ended up at the better end of that deal.
I remember when those came out, I wanted it to work so badly, because I was like, this would be incredible to be able to do so much stuff with this, and like it just wasn't there. And like I think those came out was like mid late 90s, right? Like for those. And I mean, saying that now that I have one of the, you know, the Tyler Variax guitars.
The James Tyler Variaxes, I will stand by as being actually good guitars.
Yeah, they're just, it's, and the one I have is just a gold top Les Paul style P90s. So it's just a really decent, you know, P90 guitar on its own. But then, like, for recording and a lot of that stuff, like, I use it. That's primarily where I use it, because then I can just, like, one, I don't care enough to really know that, like, well, maybe this doesn't sound exactly like a Tele, but, you know, if I'm like, well, but it gives me the ability to track a Tele and a Rick and a, you know, like Strat or something over the course of like a record with the same guitar.
Yeah.
Playing, you know, for me, it really works and I really like it, but it's like the technology, even from that, and that one's a few years old now, but even since I've updated it, but it's just so different and so good now to be able to do that. Like, I'd really like to revisit a lot of that technology somewhere.
Well, yeah, we will see. Until then, we'll be stuck with status bases with MIDI keyboards wired into the side of them. We'll get there. We'll get there eventually.
I do like status bases. That's another one of my, like, if one fell into my lap, I would be into it.
Yeah. I am big into status bases. They're another one of those brands that I think about getting all the time and then think, would my band kick me out? I mean, also, I will say that status, and I recommend both of you and all of you listeners checking out the Status website. It is hands down one of the worst websites on the internet.
Oh, yeah.
Status-graphite.com is what they've gone for, rather than status bases or anything like that. It still has an enter page, and it says, you know, something like from England to the world, which is, you know, I'm not accusing them of anything. I'm just saying, like, there's never the sort of thing you want to see when clicking on a site.
I just want to say, I just went to it, and it does have the copyright is updated, so it's still an active website.
Yeah,
this is very much reminding me of the Captain Marvel website that Marvel did, which if anyone hasn't checked it out, I highly recommend doing it.
I have not.
But they we'll do it after this.
They maybe 2-3 years ago they took on V-Man, Alex Venturella, the bass player from Slipknot, became a new artist for them. I will emphasize this was maybe 2 years ago, so this is a new thing. And if you're on their website and you scroll down, they do have promotion about his all new bass. And honestly, that page in itself, this is straight up one of the worst websites in the world. It's good that their basses are so good.
Yeah.
this is an experience being on this website.
I don't know how anyone...
I feel like I've aged by 50 years looking at it. I feel like it's turned me into...
I know this is terrible, but everyone, maybe just pause, or if you're not listening on a device that allows you to listen and check out a website, but... Oof. Their basses are very good, though.
Their bases are fantastic. I do think this website is why probably the average age of people who buy their instruments is, you know, over 50. But
I think that's also the price point.
Yeah, that is very much the price point. Yeah. What are your feelings on status bases, Naomi?
I'm looking and marveling at the finish on the... I'm not sure if the website's going to tell me what model this is. It's the one that's right in the middle of the main page of the
para,
website.
The para...
Paramatrix, is that it? It's the PJ, incidentally. The red PJ kind of offset body model. But yeah, it's a stunning finish. Honestly, my only experience of them has been hearing Alex Venturella play his. Because I'm trying to remember, I was a huge Slipknot fan back in the day, so was a huge Paul Gray fan, though I still believe he kind of got mixed into Oblivion Newstead style on most records. But he was a sick bassist. And I think, if I remember correctly, he was Warwick for a very long time, if not the entire time that he was in Slipknot. But I have noted and I'm very into Alex Venturella's tone. So again, sadly, for now, that's all I know of status bases, but... very into them sonically anyway.
They are fantastic. For me, like, the status bass that always stood out was the Buzzard, which of course they later got banned from calling it that by Warwick, as they made it with John Entwistle, the original one, and then John Entwistle moved to Warwick and then later to Dean, and the name traveled somewhat. I don't know the details of it, but status basically had to redesign the bass, and they redesigned the horns and they renamed it the B2, but the rest of the bass kind of stays as it was, and it very much has that Buzzard headstock. And for me, that bass just tonally really summarizes status, because when I think of status basses, I think of either John Entwistle and that sort of incredible, like, piano-like tone. He managed to get that incredibly heavy-handed, consistent, like almost full hi-fi tone. There's so much high mid and treble in his sound, but still such fundamentals. So I always think of status and graphite basses as being the bass that produces that. And then also, like, hearing Guy Pratt and what he did with for a lot of Pink Floyd, he was playing his signature status bass as well, and I really noticed the difference, you know, because Guy Pratt came into Pink Floyd, they had such a range of albums through the wonderful, you know, 60s and 70s to the questionable 80s and 90s, and so he's got to produce all those tones from sort of classic like P bass tone of Roger Waters right up to the sort of, you know, the that sort of cheesy 80s, you know, sort of MIDI bass tone. And so he has, obviously, his wonderful Burgundy Mist 61 or 62 jazz bass that he uses for all their older stuff, and then this fantastic graphite status base that he uses for all his modern stuff. If you want to see something funny, there's video footage of a Pink Floyd show where they'd agreed to smash all their instruments up at the end of the gig, and Guy Pratt unfortunately was playing his graphite instrument for the song where they had to smash their gear up, and so he took the bass off and swung it into the ground expecting it to smash, but all that happened was he sort of lifted off the ground at the other end and the bass stayed perfectly intact
because it's incredible.
An indestructible graphite bass, and he says himself, he talks about it actually in his stand-up about that being sort of the end of his back, but
the instrument strikes back.
Yeah, exactly. But yeah, your status bass is very cool. JD, I never asked you whether you were precision or jazz.
I think if I were buying anything, it would probably be a jazz. But the bass that was like one that got away was a 78P bass that I could have had for next to nothing. But at the time, I was playing, can't remember if it was either my like 5-string Warwick or the 5-string like custom build that I had done. So, mm-hmm. And then I was like, I don't really, I mean, it was in that time where like if it was like 400 US, which was like ridiculous, you know, it was like someone needed to make rent. I also probably just paid rent, so I was like, I couldn't, I was like, if I can have a few days to scrape up $400, I would happily get it. But yeah, like it was one of the best sounding basses I had, so I always sort of harken back for like a late 70s P, but like I'd probably get a jazz, like just because the jazz can get so P like if you just solo the, you know, the neck anyway, really. So
yeah, mm-hmm. Well, exactly, yeah, yeah, yeah. I think I agree. I'm definitely in the jazz bass camp. Despite, you know, one of the most expensive instruments I own is my 1969 Sunburst Precision Bass, which actually is the bass on all of the unreleased Polymath stuff, all of the last record we put out, and. In fact, even before I owned that, I've always used precisions for recording, but I prefer the versatility of a jazz bass, certainly for live stuff. I do think I do think generally precision basses sound good. Like I think you can spend mm-hmm. £300 on a P bass and it will sound good, mm-hmm. or you can spend $4,000 on a P bass and it would sound good. Whereas I think if you spend £300 on a jazz bass, it would sound weak. Yeah. And, you know, if you spend $4,000 on a jazz bass, it would sound fantastic. I think there's so much of a jazz bass that's in its pickups. And I've actually, thinking mm-hmm. about it, never owned a jazz bass where I haven't changed the pickups.
Yeah.
I guess I've owned 4 P basses and only changed the pickups in one. So, and that was a Mexican made one. But yeah, I like big bodied basses because they hide my belly, you know, that's always a good option. There's actually a fantastic, if anyone's thinking about vintage or retro jazz basses at the moment, just a little shout out. Sorry, everyone who's not in the UK, which is obviously over half of you. I do apologize, but I feel that I should spread the word about this instrument because it is absolutely wonderful. I'm gonna quickly put it in the chat so that you guys can all check out the link as well, but I've been eyeing this instrument up for a couple of months now. It is a 1976 natural jazz bass with a rosewood neck and perloid block inlays. It looks absolutely fantastic. I bet it sounds incredible.
Oh yeah,
it's really good. It's really good. Like it, and it's an amazing price. It's £1,849 British pounds. It's very beat up, which is hence the price. But it is very good looking relicing. It looks incredible. The problem I have, it's in Bletchingly,
and I was like, that's it.
That's it. It's collection only, and it's cash on collection only, which is like, you know, Oh, great. Okay, fine. Well, you know.
It's sort of like the anti-modern buyer, isn't it? Yes.
I know exactly who this fella is, already without meeting him. Right, Cash and Collection.
He's the final boss.
Yeah, he's the final boss.
He won't post the secondhand market, I think, isn't he?
That's exactly, exactly what it
all
is.
All of the artwork,
There's pictures in the background. Yes. I tell you what, I'll post this in the description of this podcast episode as well, and in the Facebook group. So let's
have a quick discussion about it, because maybe there's some sort of like timeshare thing we could all work out, and then so we just have like a Bass Guitar Nerds podcast, 1976, hyper authentically reliced jazz bass for whenever gigs or things.
That's it. That's a great idea. But yeah,
it's some of the nicest relicking I've ever seen.
Yeah, it's really lovely, isn't it?
Yeah, it's beautiful. And I mean, I say that as someone who has long defended the production relicking that is so popular kind of these days. That's again quite a divisive subject.
Yeah, of course.
But this as a natural relic really is stunning. I think, I think even more so because it was. Because it's natural finish to begin with, so it's like natural on natural.
Yeah. I mean, just imagine how great this would be if we took that like neck pickup and made it a P pickup, and then we drop in like a 3-band active preamp.
No. Absolutely, and actually, just spray painted a load of sea foam over it as well. Actually,
burgundy mist.
The official color of the Bass Guitar Nerds. That's what I'm going for.
I see what you're pushing for here, Joe.
It's the best color. I always got denied it on the Guitar Nerds podcast. Had to go shell pink. I'm not sure
I'm sold on it just yet.
Not burgundy mist. Well, let's talk about that. We're nearly at the end of this week's podcast. So, let's finish with that because we haven't agreed any sort of, the logo, listener, you will notice I've sort of, for the Bass Guitar Nerds podcast, I've aired towards purple and away from pink for the logo of this podcast. I also think my rendering of the Rickenbacker headstock is sort of dangerously close. It's definitely lawsuit close to it, so I may have to change that at some point. Who knows? Listeners who have been listening long enough will remember when we had a Fender headstock in our logo, and that definitely got changed at some point after an email or two. But we'll see what happens with the Rickenbacker one. But let's talk about favorite colors before we end. Like your ultimate custom shop color. Naomi, obviously, when you were given the option, you actually just went for natural on your Bronco.
I did. I'm a huge fan of natural with the right pick guard. And by the right pick guard, I mean...
Taut.
I mean taut or something pearl. Like that kind of chestnutty natural finish. I suppose a little bit like kind of koa sort of tones, with a pearl or taut pickguard is right up my street. It's not to say I don't like, solid finishes as well. I absolutely do. I'm trying to check up here on one of the finishes that Reverend do, which is their green finish. Joe, you might know the one I'm on about. The one what that the Watt Plower comes in.
Is that the one that the Mike Watt one or is
the
that
Mike Watt one? Oh, yeah. It's like a metallic green, isn't it? Like a kind of a deep metallic green. I don't know what they call that finish. I was looking at that base today, actually.
Satin emerald. Is a superb color. Satin emerald.
I just
want
to name paint colors.
I really like how Mulberry get around how Reverend get around those things, because their version of burgundy mist is called Mulberry mist, I like those little get arounds. They're cool. Well, Gibson's version of shell pink is called ocean pink.
Okay, a
nice subtle get around there.
I mean,
a reference to the pink oceans, of course.
Yeah exactly. When I think of oceans, I'm like, oh, that is pink.
It's so pink.
Just like Steven Tyler, pink is my favorite color.
To finish, I would say I would lean heavily towards greens, turquoises, Sherwood green, which I feel like Fender didn't do for a very long time. Sherwood green metallic, and green seems to be making a little bit of a comeback in the last kind of 2 years with their ranges.
Often in
the sort of pastel format, and I'm not a fan of the pastel colours. I need something a bit more with a bit more substance to it than the pastel colours. I want to see more seafoam than... Oh no, do I mean seafoam? What are the two greens that Fender do?
There's the olive green which came in... Do you remember the olive green that came in about 2016, 2017 in the American Professionals?
Oh yes, I remember that. I remember that.
I feel like that was the first to be reintroduced outside of kind of the seafoam green, Daphne blue sort of pastels that you're talking about. Yeah. And then they what is their really out there finish that they have on the lead?
I'm not 100% sure. The green that really stood out for me that Fender did was what, sorry?
I'm just looking up the name of this absolutely neon green that they've done currently. If it is neon green, I'll leave my hat, but I don't think it is.
It's neon green.
To answer your question in two words, as opposed to the 500 that I just did, it would be neon green, Joe.
Fair enough. Yeah, the seafoam green, I think, was the green that always really appealed to me that Fender did.
I've
put a link again in the chat for you guys now, which I'll do again in the Facebook community and the link of this podcast. Specific bass that was a custom shop. It's a custom shop jazz bass that came into GAC in my time working there, which for the entire time that I was in charge of the bass department, I had sat behind my head at the desk so that it was least likely for anyone to buy it, because I loved that bass. It was a jazz bass with no scratch plate, so it was just completely seafoam green, 70s styled with a it's a 60s headstock logo, but yeah, 70s styled, mm-hmm. in that it had a rosewood neck and big perloid block inlays and 60s pickup configuration as well.
It's very cool. I just want to start with that. It also looks like the bass that the Simpsons would draw, or that some sort of animated show when they have a bass player would do. So it's like, it's a bass, like, here's basically what it needs. And then it's like, oh, it's one color green. And then, oh yeah, I've seen those things on it. Like when you see like in someone doing controls. Animation who doesn't actually play guitar or bass or something. It's like,
yeah.
Oh, look at this. Here's a guitar with two strings and things. Hmm. It's not morphine. One for the kids.
Yeah.
I have to ask, Joe, the simplicity of the body is what I think is so beautiful when you see it in a jazz body like that with no pick guard. So you've just got your controls, your pickups and your bridge. Is the fact that there is technically more seafoam green, is that part of your reasoning for really liking this one and trying to have sabotaged any potential sale of this bass?
Unfortunately, this bass did sell years ago. I do look out for it every now and again, because it was a custom shop that we spec'd in the shop. And I was annoyed because I spec'd this one up and I asked for drill holes. For the plate, which it didn't come with, which I guess I could have done myself, but you know, nonetheless, I really liked the idea of there being drill holes. That was just my incredibly specific requirements for the bass. But yeah, you know, that was back in the days. But I think that probably sold for $2,500 new. You know, and now I reckon something like that specced up in the Fender custom shop would be like 3.8, 3.9 in pounds.
I was going to say 4, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, for sure.
So, yeah, a wonderful bass that got away. JD, favorite finish?
So if I'm absolutely honest, it's natural. Like I have a few stages of this. So I think anything I've purchased in the last, quite long time, it's like it's always been natural because I want to see the wood, because I want to see, you know, like I like all the grain, you know, like I think, you know, like you've seen my bass, I have a big knot on the top of my bass, like I really like the organicness of all of that, and I sort of don't want to hide it. Failing that, like I think it's hard to go wrong with like a black or an Olympic white kind of thing with tort if there's a scratch plate, for sure. And then anything else, I've had like bursts and things, and those are great, and they almost feel natural in a sense, depending on the burst. But like, I want something quite colorful, you know, like I would want something that is just like audacious, like we're talking about with like red and gold hardware, or like something is like the translucent electric blues that you used to see in like the late 90s on like Samick bases and things like that. Yeah. You know, a lot of times just like something that's like, oh yeah, this definitely a normal thing that you would see in nature or something, you know. But yeah, like I really like loud bass. I always gravitate more towards like a natural finish, and not necessarily, and I mean, also most of my basses are oil finished. They're not like lacquer or nitro or anything. So it's sort of like, I like a matte finish as well. And that's just sort of my vibe. But, I mean, I say that as I'm staring at this Seafoam green bass that I did, to be fair, start out with saying that I really like it. So, but you know, like something like that's really growing on me, but I just don't know that I like, it's weird. Just like, I really like it. I just don't know that I would play it. Like, I'd want to see underneath it, you know, kind of thing, I think.
Yeah. Yeah. I totally get that. I was thinking about this question the other day, and I realized that I think my favorite finish is Sunburst, which is incredibly boring. But yeah, I agree with you, JD, and Naomi as well. I guess I really like having that natural finish, being that sort of woodiness being a part of the bass. I like that sort of rich, you know, characterfulness of an instrument rather than it just being sort of a straight color.
Yeah, for sure. And I mean, I don't know, is it having worked around acoustic instruments for my time in stores as well, but I think there's a little bit like we were talking about earlier, just that, you know, quite a lot of basses end up with just really interesting wood combinations as well. Whether it was a jazz bass I saw years ago, which was Okoumi, mm-hmm. Which I believe is an African wood. You know, they've done walnut bodies, even mahogany, even like natural mahogany to me is stunning. So I would be a fan of showcasing the instrument for what it is in a lot of cases.
Yeah. Yeah, 100%. Fender actually did a run of precision and jazz basses in Okoumi.
Yes, that's the one. That's the one I'm talking about.
Ah, yes.
Yeah, no, they sounded incredible as well.
Yeah, they were great. Yeah, like mm-hmm. a really, kind of exactly what you expect from those sorts of woods. It was like a richer and more defined low end.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I thought, yeah, they were awesome. But that brings us up to the end of this week's episode of the Bass Guitar Nerds podcast. Thank you very much, listener, for tuning into this week. You can, of course, join us over on Patreon at patreon.com/guitar nerds. Also join our Facebook community at facebook.com/groups/guitar nerds forum, and you can follow us on any of the major social platforms with @guitar nerds. And we'll be back week after next with another episode of the Basic Guitar Nerds podcast. We'll be back next week with a regular episode of the Guitar Nerds podcast. We'll see you then for more of this guitar nerdery. Farewell.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.